William Morrow and Harper Audio present The Lightning Rod, a Zig and Nola novel by Brad Meltzer. Performed by Scott Brick. In each of us, there is another whom we do not know. Carl Jung. Prologue. Elmswood, Pennsylvania. These were the last 14 minutes of his life. "Whoa, Joe, you're up," a valet with watery eyes announced as a midnight blue BMW turned the corner and crept up the driveway. Anthony Wojowicz was older, 32, which made him practically geriatric in the valet scene. But with parents who worked in the mine, truly in the mine, his stepdad worked days. His mom used to work the hoot owl shift overnight. Wojo wasn't afraid of hard work. Ever since he was little, Wojo had considered himself a lucky guy. When he was a kid, a pickup truck hit his friend as they stepped off the curb, missing Wojo by inches. It was the same when his older cousin stole Wojo's Halloween candy one year, then got sick from a pot brownie that was accidentally distributed. As Wojo got older, his overstyled messy black hair starting to recede, everything didn't go his way. His ex-wife was proof of that. But he was lucky to have his new girlfriend. He'd met her in an elevator of all places. Lucky that they found that mole on his back early, and especially lucky that when he got fired from LensCrafters, he found this job, parking cars at Barron's Steakhouse. During his time at LensCrafters, Wojo's child support was deducted directly from his paycheck. Here, as a valet, he got tips in cash, which not only gave him some breathing room, but also gave him a way to save up for that birthday party at the indoor skydiving place in Philly that Gabriella, his 10-year-old daughter, was begging for. His ex said no to the party. But with what Wojo was going to clear this weekend, he'd have enough to say yes. With a quick rub of his crooked nose, Wojo jogged toward the BMW, forcing a smile at the driver. Years ago, his stepdad had told him that anyone who drives a BMW has a small penis. Wojo always liked his stepdad. And the fact that the car here was a 2013 128i coupe? Come on. There were Camrys more expensive than that. Small fry, Wojo decided. Not nearly big enough for what he had planned. "Good evening," Wojo announced as the door to the BMW swung open. "Welcome to Barron's Steakhouse." "Don't readjust my seat," a commanding baritone insisted. The 40-something driver was big, built like a bulldozer, and the car seemed to tip as he got out. Stubborn lips, military posture, the buzzed blonde hair made Wojo think of Captain America. But it wasn't until the man stood up straight that Wojo spotted his $7,000 Panerai watch. Before Wojo could say a word, the driver slapped his keys against Wojo's chest. Fwap! That was the moment. As the keys smacked him in the chest, as Captain America brushed past him without any eye contact, that Wojo made a fatal decision. "After this, I'm on break, yes?" Wojo called out to his watery-eyed boss. Watery eyes nodded. That would give Wojo 20 minutes. Sliding into the BMW, Wojo readjusted the front seat and put the car into drive. The interior was pristine, but Wojo's eyes were on the rear view as he waited for Captain America to disappear into the restaurant. With a tap of the gas, the car inched forward toward the valet lot. But as soon as Wojo arrived in the lot, he headed for the lot's back exit, made a quick left, and hit the gas out onto Route 1. On the steering wheel, he pressed the small button that showed the cartoon headshot of a little man with three tiny parentheses coming out of his mouth. There was a loud beep. Voice command. "Go home," Wojo announced, The center screen lit up and an address appeared, 2678 Ocean Avenue. Wojo grinned. Like anyone else in middle age, Captain America was too old to realize nothing good comes from putting your home address into your car's GPS. Start guidance, Wojo said, hitting the button again. Plotting a route to home, the female computer voice replied. 9 minutes away. Not bad at all. Lucky, lucky. Wojo thought again of the $7,000 watch. Good sign. So was the address on Ocean Avenue. Even now, as he turned off Route 1 and passed the golf course that marked the edge of Elmswood's oldest suburb, Wojo told himself he was a good person. He didn't think of himself as a thief, but he was. His rationalization was his daughter, of course, and that he was always a gentleman about it. When it came to picking marks, he only chose the snobs, the ones so caught up in their own self-importance they couldn't muster a simple hello or, God forbid, a thank you. Manners. Decency. What the hell was wrong with the world these days? More important, Wojo was smart about it. He wouldn't run in and rob people blind. If he did, it wouldn't take long for the police to figure out that all the victims had eaten dinner at the same restaurant. He had rules, and he stuck to them. Trips like this were only once a month, twice during that month when his sister was going through her divorce. And instead of grabbing everything in sight, he only took one item. A ring, a bracelet. On his best night, a sapphire necklace. When a single piece of jewelry goes missing, people don't call the cops. They blame themselves and assume it's lost. 7 months in, with 8 jobs done, Wojo still hadn't been proven wrong. In 1,000 feet, make a right, the computerized female voice announced as he blew past the white painted brick colonial where he'd grabbed that 4-carat heirloom ring a few months back. 4 minutes left to live. Pausing at a stop sign, Wojo glanced around at the black leather interior of the BMW. His stepdad was wrong. This car was nice. So was the neighborhood, though that wasn't a surprise. With a menu that had a $145 tomahawk ribeye chop, Barron's Steakhouse attracted the best around. Destination ahead. On the left, the female voice added. Cul-de-sac. Naturally. The mainstay of every suburban ecosystem. Wojo shifted in his seat, feeling that tingle in his crotch. This wasn't better than sex. And certainly wasn't better than sex with Darla, the energy drink sales rep who he'd met in the elevator and did that thing with her tongue. But it was close. Pulling into the driveway and squinting through the dark, Wojo took a good long look at the tasteful yellow ranch-style house. 4 bedrooms at least, maybe 5. Nothing breathtaking, but that inlaid brick front path and the freshly planted flowers out front, Captain America was doing just fine. As Wojo shut off the car, he waited a few seconds, double-checking that all the house lights were out. No one home. Clipped to the sun visor was a small gray remote, garage door opener. He pressed it with his thumb. If Wojo was really lucky. The garage door yawned open, revealing storage boxes, bicycles, a spare freezer, and a workbench that looked like it hadn't been touched in years. If Wojo had looked closer, he would have spotted the empty gun safe along the back wall. Ducking into the garage, Wojo pounded the door close button on the right-hand wall, and suddenly, he couldn't get the song Total Eclipse of the Heart by Bonnie Tyler out of his head. Turn around, bright eyes, he mentally sang as the garage door lowered, swallowing him whole. Even in the dark, Wojo could see the keypad for the alarm. As always, he reached for his phone, which held an app that would help him unlock it. For years now, Every alarm company had had to file their particular transmitter frequencies with the FCC, which made them publicly available. For real, publicly available. Most door and window sensors operate at 315.0 megahertz, so all you have to do is copy that frequency to jam it. But as Wojo got closer to the keypad, still singing in his head how forever was gonna start tonight, he saw that a bright green light was on. Alarm wasn't even armed. Lucky night for sure, Wojo thought, picturing his daughter Gabriella in skydiving pose, arms outstretched, the wind widening her smile so much she was nothing but teeth. All that was left was... Wojo gave the doorknob a twist. Locked. But not for long. From his pocket, he pulled out a keyring filled with bump keys, the same ones locksmiths used. It took two tries to find the right one. Then, click. The door swung open, and Wojo was hit with a whiff of a stale mop and bleach. Laundry room on his left. In his pocket, Wojo slid his hand around the small black stun gun he always carried on these trips, just in case someone jumped out of the dark. Inside the house, everything was silent. No barking, no obvious pets. A good sign. In 2.5 minutes, the blood would be everywhere. Right now, he was slow walking through the family room, eyeing the cherry floors and the built-in bookcases that were filled with kids' DVDs and far too many Tom Hanks movies. Captain America had a wife and teenage kids by the looks of the photos on an end table. When it came to decor, the family had spent money on a couch, a modern chocolate brown leather sectional. But everything else, rugs, coffee table, shabby chic slip-covered chairs, was like a Pottery Barn, West Elm, and Crate and Barrel bomb went off. All of it in its prime a decade ago, just like the BMW. Every life has a peak. 10 years ago was when Cap was really making money. Along the far wall was a framed revolver, an antique buccaneer-style flintlock pistol from the 1700s, complete with a wide brass barrel like something from Pirates of the Caribbean. Worth at least $3,000, Wojo knew, though he walked right past it. Something that big goes missing, the cops get called. Besides, he knew where the real rewards were. Following the house's main artery, Wojo made a left toward the master bedroom. He wasn't walking gingerly anymore. Too excited. Down the hallway, he saw the way the bedroom opened to the right, toward suburbia's real prize. His and hers closets. According to home security experts, during a break-in, the very first place that criminals go is the top drawer of a woman's dresser. As a result, women are never supposed to hide their jewelry there. But most women did it anyway, not wanting to deal with the headache of moving their favorite items in and out of a safe. A flush of adrenaline lifted Wojo's chest. Yet as he stepped over the threshold and made a right toward the closets, he was surprised to hear click. A light in the room popped on. Wojo squinted, blinded. "You really think we wouldn't find out?" asked a man wearing a latex Oscar the Grouch mask. He was on the opposite side of the bed, which was drowning in throw pillows. In the man's hand was a gun, an M1911 military pistol aimed straight at Wojo's face. "This isn't," Wojo said. "I wasn't." "You should know better. I know you know better." Oscar the Grouch exploded, his voice muffled by the mask, which was deflated and misshapen, wobbly on his head. Even with his navy sweatshirt and baggy jeans, it was clear he was well-built, though he had a natural impatience in his stance, ready to spring. His hands were bony and pale white. Wojo backed up into the wall, his face burning with fear. A single thought filled his brain. He didn't know the why or the how. Did they follow him? But one thing was clear. This was no longer a robbery. It was a trap. 2 minutes to go. I'm a good person, Wojo insisted. This wasn't... My daughter... Done. No, the grouch shouted, his finger on the trigger. Wojo dropped to his knees, keeping his head toward the floor. I didn't take anything. Just let me stop talking. Wojo lowered his head farther, practically curling into himself. When bombs go off and horrors happen in the real world, people say that time seems to slow down. That's not true. It actually seems to go faster, but it's happening at such an accelerated rate, the human brain can barely register everything it's experiencing. At this moment, that's where Wojo was. The grouch was shouting now, "You know what you did!" But Wojo didn't hear it. As the grouch came closer, Wojo noticed a noise, a deep k-clack. The hammer on the pistol. The grouch had pulled it back, and now all Wojo could see was his daughter, crying, sobbing. Her birthday. She'd forever link his death with her birthday. 90 seconds to go. "Look at me," the grouch shouted. Wojo refused, his brain catapulting back to his ex-wife, to their first apartment, to Gabriella being born, to standing outside the steakhouse and the burst of ego and anger that brought him to this Wait. In his pocket. The stun gun. He still had the... The grouch was close now, so close that Wojo could smell the latex of the mask, could smell the way the man's jeans reeked of sawdust and... Pick your head up. Wojo still didn't pick his head up. He was curled tight, his hand snaking down to his own pocket. 72 seconds. You do realize this is your doing, the grouch added, pressing the barrel into the crown of Wojo's head. A plump vein swelled on the grouch's hand as his finger tightened on the trigger. You understand that? He asked, like he was waiting for an answer. In 1 minute. Wojo would be dead. But he still had a minute. I asked you a question. Wojo pulled the taser from his pocket, squeezing the trigger so fast he felt an electric snake bite in his own leg as he whipped out the weapon. The stun gun had 2 metal fangs at the end of it, which Wojo stabbed straight into the grouch's left thigh. The taser's blue light crackled like a mini lightning storm. Gah! The grouch shouted, his leg going limp, his whole body falling sideways like a cleaved tree. 40 seconds to... Go, 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 Wojo thought, scrambling to his feet. The stun gun would buy him a moment. Wojo ran from the room and darted through the house, back toward the front door. As he ran, he was still squeezing the trigger, the blue electricity crackling as it lit his way. In seconds, Wojo was outside, the summer air licking his face. Until that moment, he didn't realize how hard he was sweating. His heart punched in his chest. Up the block, he spotted the red rear lights of a car leaving, though he barely registered it. He looked around, panicked, lost, like he'd awoken in a strange hotel and couldn't quite figure out where he was. There, the car he came in. The BMW. Sprinting for the car, Wojo ripped open the door and slid inside. He pulled the keys from his pocket and threw the stun gun aside. But just as he went to start the car, from the back seat, a thick forearm wrapped around Wojo's neck. Behind him, in the back seat, someone was already in the car, waiting for him. Wojo caught a glimpse in the rear view. That buzzed blonde hair. You think I'm blind? Captain America roared, tightening his chokehold. I forgot my jacket in the car, and when I came out, you think I wouldn't see you leave? Please, you don't understand, Wojo pleaded, realizing that the car he saw leaving was a taxi. Cap was a man of action. He'd jumped in a cab to race back home. Please. Inside, Wojo added, twisting wildly, fighting to get loose, clawing at his own neck. Cap's grip was too strong. Wojo was thrashing now, his face a pale purple, tears squeezing out behind his eyes. He could picture Oscar the Grouch and his misshapen mask. By now, the taser would be wearing off. He'd be here soon. You steal my car, Cap roared. 10 seconds. And break into my house? If we don't, please. Wojo begged. If we don't go,
He'll kill us.
He? Captain America asked. Who's he?
Tink, tink.
Outside the driver's window, a knuckle tapped against the glass. In perfect sync, both Wojo and Captain America turned left, looking up at a saggy, askew Oscar the Grouch mask. The man in the mask raised his gun.
Pht, pht.
Two quick shots, then a third when he saw who else was in the back seat. Anthony Wojowicz wilted sideways. A small burn mark from the bullet appeared in his temple and sent a spray of blood across the passenger seat, dead at 32 years old. Behind him, Captain America, an army veteran named Archie Mint, slumped forward, a matching burn mark on his cheek. Wojo's luck had finally run out, but when it came to Archie Mint, well, even in death, Mint still had a bit of luck coming.
1. Wunderly Square, Pennsylvania.
4 hours. He spent 4 hours working on her body.
Ziggy, let her be. She looks good.
Good? Jim Zagorowski asked, standing over the coffin, makeup brush in his hand. Not great?
Let me rephrase. Great. Beautiful.
Michelangelo would say you're Michelangelo, said Puerto Rican Andy. Zig never liked the name, but Andy had been calling himself that since fourth grade, when there were 3 Andys in his class. Today, at 300 pounds, Puerto Rican Andy lumbered through the viewing room at Calta's funeral home, carrying a metal easel with a bushel of bright daisies that he placed at the foot of the coffin. She hasn't looked this good since Reagan was president.
Don't listen to him, ma'am,
Zig whispered, leaning down toward the dead elderly woman with high cheekbones and pale pink lipstick. Fallen, number 2546. Mrs. Leslie Paoli, 93 years old. Dead from stomach cancer, and whatever else you catch when you spend your last decade in a nursing home.
You look even more beautiful now, Mrs. Paoli.
Zig meant it. For 4 hours, he'd polished her nails, cleaned her dentures, used putty and makeup to cover the bruises on her neck and arms from all the machines at the hospital, and washed and restyled her hair, which probably hadn't been shampooed in months. He even put her in the same dress, gold sequins with a crystal butterfly pin at the shoulder that she was wearing in the photo next to her
Boss man, they're here!
Puerto Rican Andy called out, sweat running down his shaved head, skating toward his neck tattoo, a phoenix that poked out from the collar of his white dress shirt. Andy was big and looked like a convict, but as his parole officer had told Zig, the phoenix referred to Dumbledore, Puerto Rican Andy being the biggest Harry Potter fan in rural Pennsylvania.
Ravenclaw,
Andy would say to anyone who asked.
Boss man, you hear what I...
One more sec, Zig said, adding some final blush to Mrs. Paoli's cheeks. As always, the hardest part was getting the coloring just right. People think corpses are gray, but by the time they arrive at a funeral home, they're white. Like geishas, Zig's mentor used to say. Once your heart stops and your body is on its back for a few hours, gravity sets in, blanching your face, chest, and legs. That is, unless an artful mortician gives you back your color.
I told you, ma'am. We'll take care of you,
Zig whispered, moving a stray silver hair from her forehead and flashing that charming smile that had gotten every Mahjong group gossiping back when he first moved to the small town of Wunderly Square. Zig's silver and black hair was shorter now, for summer. Across his jaw was the hairline scar that he'd used to his advantage during those wild years after his divorce. For most of his adult life, Zig had been a mortician at Dover Air Force Base, home of the mortuary for the U.S. government's most high-profile and top-secret cases. On 9/11, the victims of the Pentagon attack were sent to Dover. So were the hostages who were killed in Beirut, the victims who were shot at Fort Hood, and the remains of well over 50,000 soldiers and CIA operatives who'd fought in Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, and every secret location in between. In Delaware, of all places, at Dover Air Force Base, was America's most secretive funeral home. 2 years earlier, Zig had left it all behind. There was too much pain, too many old scars torn open from spending every day with dead young soldiers. Within a month, he'd found the job here at Cultus Funeral Home, in a building that, back in the 70s, had been a Dairy Queen, complete with a red mansard roof that was now painted beige. Zig took it as a sign, hoping things could be a bit more nice and easy. But really, when was anything in life nice and easy? "I'm looking for Jim Zigarowski," a man in his late 30s called out, stepping into the viewing room, then taking a half step back once he spotted the coffin. He wore a shiny blue suit, no tie, like he was going to a beachfront wedding. "You must be Mr. DeSantis," Zig said as the man took off his Mercedes baseball cap, which he'd clearly gotten from the dealership. "Is he actually wearing a Mercedes hat?" Puerto Rican Andy whispered. 10 points from Slytherin. Is she? DeSantis motioned to the coffin. "Your mother is mother-in-law. She's mother-in-law," DeSantis insisted. "My apologies," Zig said, putting on his funeral home voice, which made him sound like an NPR host. "As you'll see, we got her all cleaned up. So if you want to take a look..."
"You mean at the body? No. No, no, no."
DeSantis laughed nervously.
"We'd rather remember her how she lived, not how she died," he explained, glancing around at the chairs, the flowers, even at the framed vintage metal sign from the funeral home's original 1908 location. "Offering understanding," it read in antique lettering. He glanced around at everything, really, except Mrs. Paoli. "Anyway, if you wouldn't mind, you know, closing it," he said, pointing with his fancy baseball cap toward the coffin.
"Of course," Zig replied with a polite grin. DeSantis stood there an extra few seconds.
"Gotta be a horrible way to go, right? Like I told my own kids, don't ever put me in a nursing home. Last thing I want is to spend my final years collecting dust."
Zig nodded, still faking a grin. But as he looked around the ancient funeral home, Zig was surprised by how much the words stung. Collecting dust. Was that all he was doing these days? DeSantis headed out to his family as Zig felt a buzz in his pocket, his phone vibrating. To his surprise, caller ID showed a familiar number. 302-677 prefix. Dover Air Force Base. The life he'd left behind.
"Ziggy, it's Will. What's cooking, good looking?" Will with one L announced.
Enthusiasm was always Will's major. But Zig and Will weren't buddies or even acquaintances. In the 2 years since Zig left Dover, Will had called him a grand total of 0 times. Still, Zig was so surprised by the call, he didn't give it much thought. That was his first mistake.
"How's private practice?" Will asked.
"Wonderful. Couldn't be better," Zig said, eyeing Mrs. Paoli frozen in her coffin.
"Listen, sorry to bother you, but we got a case that just came through. A lieutenant colonel."
"One of our own," Will explained, meaning it was someone who worked at Dover. "The point being, the funeral's near you, just a few towns over, and we want the body treated perfectly, so..." He put on his best godfather voice.
"You up for letting us pull you back in?"
Wow. Al Pacino impression. Topical. Want to hear my Mr. T?
"I'm serious, Ziggy. We could use the help. It's a good case.
Funeral's tomorrow. You up for this or not?
Zig stared at the coffin, at Mrs. Paoli and the crystal butterfly on her dress. Outside, down the hallway, De Sanctis was grabbing a handful of mints from the welcome bowl and stuffing them in his pocket.
Yeah, I'm in, Zig said, thinking maybe this was just what he needed.
The following morning, Zig left his house at 5 a.m., his camouflage backpack stocked with his mortician kit, baggies, modeling clay, makeup, and all his tools, including scalpels, forceps, draining tubes, and even a sternal saw, just in case. Running down the front steps, he felt good to be in the mix, to be helping a family that truly needed his expertise. Zig was a sculptor. With bullet wounds to the face, you need to be prepared for the worst. And he was. But the one thing Zig wasn't prepared for and didn't see was the man with the buzzed hair and pointy face who was parked diagonally across the street. From his own car, the man watched Zig leave his house and head down the front steps, a travel mug of coffee in his hands. If Zig was smart or even a bit suspicious, he would have checked over his own shoulder. But the only ones who do that, the man thought to himself, are those who know they're in trouble.
2.
Zig knew that sound, the low mesmerizing hum vibrating through the building. It was coming from the school's gym, the only place in town big enough to hold the nearly 1,000 mourners who were packed into the bleachers, waiting to pay their respects. It was the same in every small town. Fallen soldiers' funerals were community events. Outside, fire engines lined the streets, flags hung from every storefront, and folks lined up early. From the rumble, the crowd was restless. "You got a prep room for me?" Zig called out, moving fast, like he was in an emergency room scene on one of those doctor TV shows, both hands on the metal rolling cart that held the flag-covered coffin. Fallen number 2547, Lieutenant Colonel Archie Mint, 48 years old. Almost my age, Zig thought, steering the coffin down the long hallway of Elmswood High, pretending it was normal to push a coffin down the corridor of a high school. "End of the hall, make a left," said the man who was running just ahead of the coffin. Clifford. Like the big red dog, Zig thought, nodding thanks as he followed the thin 6'4", 60-year-old man with a mediocre handshake and the build of a Q-tip. God, why does the head of every local funeral home always look the part? A prep room? Is the damage really that bad? Clifford asked. Zig stayed silent, spotting a stray blue thread on the American flag. He reached down to grab it. Whether it was a 93-year-old civilian or a 48-year-old lieutenant colonel, every one of the fallen deserved the very best. "We'll take care of you, Archie," Zig whispered toward the coffin. The tricky part was that in summer heat like this, the coffin acts like an oven. Makeup on the fallen soldier begins to melt. So does the wax that's used to smooth over bullet holes or other wounds in the victim's face. "Mr. Zigarowski, I should warn you." "Mint's family," Clifford said. "His wife wants an open casket. But maybe we should just tell her she's getting an open casket," Zig insisted, picking up speed. With a sharp left, Zig turned the corner, leaving the narrow hallway. Royal blue metal lockers with built-in combination locks lined one wall. A colorful hand-painted mural of Martin Luther King Jr. lined the other, along with an educational poster that read, "Don't quit your daydream." As Zig looked around, something clenched in his chest. "You okay?" Clifford asked. Zig nodded, taking a half step back, his heart feeling like it was made from a thin-stretched cloth.
"This school. My daughter went to this school," Zig thought, though he knew that wasn't quite right.
The layout, the bright blue lockers,
Even this exact gray and white checkerboard linoleum floor.
It was the same layout the Pennsylvania Department of Education used for dozens of local high schools, including the one in Zig's hometown, where he used to take
Magpie,
Zig thought. His daughter, Maggie. Images flooded forward, and there she was. He could see her, back from the dead as old memories were laid over this new one. Young Maggie walking down the hallway, running her fingertips across the combination locks, sending their dials spinning like pinwheels, each of them losing steam, slowing, returning to their lifeless, inert state. Maggie was only 12 years old when she died, but right now, Zig could see her so clearly. The light freckles on her nose, the smell of Thin Mints on her breath, and of course, that night at the Girl Scout campout, when a soda can exploded in the campfire, sending shards of metal straight for Maggie's face. On that night, fellow Girl Scout Nola Brown shoved Maggie out of the way, saving Maggie's life and giving Zig an extra year with his daughter. The time went too fast. Zig suddenly picturing Nola when he saw her 2 years ago on that case they worked together at Dover. The hardest part was seeing Nola fully grown, a reminder of what Maggie never got to experience. He could still see his daughter now, walking hallways, just like this every Tuesday and Thursday afternoon, so she could take singing lessons with Mrs. O'Keefe, the choir teacher. "Igarowski, you hear what I said?" Clifford asked, Zig now humming that song he'd been practicing in choir, La Vie Bohème, from Rent. Even then, Zig knew that Maggie's favorite part was watching Zig squirm when she sang all the curse words. 6 days after her final choir practice, Maggie was dead on that night that Zig could still conjure so quickly. It was the most potent weapon in grief's arsenal. The speed of its return.
Yeah. No, I'm fine, Zig insisted as they reached the double metal doors at the far end of the hallway.
Weight room. Athletes only. One of the few rooms with a doorframe wide enough for a casket.
We tried cleaning it up, Clifford said, motioning to the bench press and squat rack that were shoved into the corner.
But all Zig could focus on were the two men across the room, blocking the doorway to a connecting conference room. Both were beefy, late 20s, in tight suits that they hadn't worn since high school. Local firemen, Zig wagered, or cops. With big funerals like this, you hire all the local help you can get. Though the way they were standing at the threshold, like Secret Service agents, their real job was to protect.
Oh, Tessa, a woman's voice called out. Tessa, I'm so sorry.
There was a chorus of sniffling and nose blowing. The family. Zig could feel them, even from here. Before Zig could react, the door slammed shut, the two beefy guys following Clifford into the room with the family, which left Zig alone. No surprise. No one wants to be with the body.
Okay, Colonel. It's just us now. You can tell all the dirty jokes you want, Zig whispered, locking the wheels of the rolling cart and taking off his camouflage backpack.
By the way, your family loves you. A lot. With a gentle tug, Zig removed the flag from the coffin and folded it carefully, making sure it never touched the floor.
I saw your wife next door.
Lucky man, Zig said, now thinking of his own ex, which caught him by surprise. They'd been divorced for nearly 15 years.
Just remember, sir, your wife was lucky to have you, too.
Zig snapped on a pair of nitrile medical gloves, then lowered his head for the quick prayer he said in every case.
Please give me strength to take care of the fallen, so their family can begin healing.
Yet no matter how much strength Zig prayed for, he knew the grieving family would always need more.
At that moment, Zig thought that the government was taking extra good care of Mint.
But as he was about to find out, he had no idea what the government was really up to. Unhooking the coffin's wooden latch,
Zig lifted the lid and got his first good look inside at Archie Mint's broken body.
3. A clear plastic bag covered Lieutenant Colonel Mint's face like he was suffocating. Standard Dover procedure, to make sure that in transit, makeup didn't get on the fallen soldier's uniform. Zig pulled out his phone and some earbuds. Fighting the urge to put on La Vie Boheme, he instead went with Paul Simon's Graceland, Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes. Zig's best work was always done with music.
There you go. Just like that,
Zig said, gently removing the plastic, then carefully lowering the colonel's head back onto the satin pillow.
You earned your rest, sir,
Zig said, taking a longer look at Mint's face. Chiseled features, jaw like a movie star. Handsome, even now, Zig thought, noticing the ribbon rack on Mint's chest decorated with medals. Among them, one stood out. The soldier's medal, which was awarded for a heroic act that didn't involve enemy combat, like saving someone in a fire.
Real superhero, huh?
Zig asked as Paul Simon sang in his ear about a poor boy who was empty as a pocket with nothing to lose. Whoever prepped the body at Dover had done tremendous work. The problem was, so had the heat. With the high temperatures in the hearse, the molding clay that had been used to rebuild the colonel's face was now waxy and melted, revealing the outlines of the bullet hole in his cheek, as well as the pockmarks from the glass that had torn through his skin. According to the medical examiner's report, Mint was shot through a car window.
Mr. Zigarowski, I'm sorry to do this, but in terms of timeline,
Clifford called, sticking his head in the room. He motioned to Mint's family behind him.
They want to know when they can begin.
5 minutes, Zig said as Clifford shut the door. Turning up the Paul Simon, Zig pulled out a bottle of...
Got you some lighter fluid,
he told the colonel, wetting a makeup brush with one of the few liquids that would break down the wax and make it more pliable.
Don't tell the suburban moms. This is the cheapest facelift of all.
With a few artful swirls of the makeup brush, Zig slowly redistributed the wax, meticulously re-sculpting everything back into place.
This was Zig's gift. No matter how bad the damage, he could put back together what had been taken apart, giving families a sense of closure they never thought they'd...
Someone coughed.
Zig looked up, pulling out his earbuds. The family... She has a question for you,
Clifford explained, stepping aside and revealing a woman with chestnut-colored hair that was pulled back in a faultless bun.
She was petite, compact, but solid in her shoulders, radiating strength.
Definitely military, Zig thought. Lieutenant Colonel Mint's wife, Tessa.
We were just hoping.
Tessa motioned to the body.
These are for the coffin, she said, handing Zig an Adidas sneaker box with no lid.
Inside were a few old photos, a worn leather baseball glove, and a single yellow post-it with a handwritten note that read, "You can." Tessa started to explain, but she didn't have to. Behind her, frozen in the doorway, were two kids. A lanky 17-year-old boy with blonde hair like his dad's and a neck that curved like a comma, and a black-haired girl who was clutching a cell phone with two hands like she was strangling it. The girl was 12, with doubting eyes and dark scabs on both her knees and elbows. Zig liked her immediately, especially when he saw what was written on the child-sized baseball glove.
Make sure I win this week, Daddy. Love, Violet.
If it's okay, I'd like to see him now, Mint's wife said, leaning hard on the word I. She wasn't letting her children any closer, standing in front of them like a lioness, one arm blocking their way.
Of course, ma'am. Let me just...
Tearing off a strip of gray masking tape, Zig wrapped it around his hand, sticky side out. With a steady, almost reverent stroke, he rolled the tape,
which was stronger than any lint brush, from Lieutenant Colonel Mint's chest down to the white gloves on his hands, which were, as always, positioned left over right, so the wedding hand had prominence. As the tape kissed the wrist of the colonel's white gloves, the lip of the right glove lifted, revealing a plastic glove inside. Another Dover custom to keep body fluids from seeping out. Inside that glove, Zig noticed a spot of blood from three deep scratches on the back of the colonel's hand. Zig made a mental note. Bodies get scratched all the time, but in the Dover report that Zig saw, there was no mention of it. To make sure the family didn't see the blood, Zig quickly readjusted the colonel's hands to make sure the left completely covered the right, moving the colonel's thumb just so. "He'd appreciate your sense of perfection," Tessa said. "When he ate, he wouldn't let any of his food touch each other. Even spaghetti and meatballs," she explained, her voice catching as she laughed and cried in the same breath. She was strong, trying to use humor as armor. But as Tessa stepped forward to finally see her dead husband up close, well, at the real ground zero of it all, there's no protection strong enough. "I thought he'd... they told me he wouldn't look this good," Tessa said, her face lighting up with... it could only be described as relief. It's what military families understood better than anyone. The simultaneous terror and joy that comes from seeing your loved one last time. "His face. They said the bullet... he looks beautiful," she blurted, the tears now rolling down her cheeks. "You got his smile right, too. He was a terrible smiler." Even the kids started to laugh. "Thank you for this. He deserves no less," Zig thought to himself. "I'm serious," Tessa added. "What you did was magic." "I used to work at Dover, too," Zig explained. "I appreciate his service there." "Who? Archie?" "Archie was in the reserves. He never worked at Dover," Tessa said, looking confused. "I think you..." "Ma'am, we should really get going," one of the funeral employees, a man with a flat nose, interrupted, cutting in front of Zig. Zig backed up out of respect, but was lost. Yesterday, when Will called, he'd insisted that Mint was one of ours, a Dover employee. "Ma'am, the crowd's waiting," Flat Nose added, Zig now noticing the fresh shine on the man's shoes. Zig had thought he was a fireman or a cop, but a shine like that, that was military polish, like he was wearing the rumpled suit to blend in. There was a bulge at the back of Flat Nose's jacket, definitely carrying a gun. Flat Nose gave a nod, and a phalanx of volunteers appeared from nowhere, swirling around the coffin, carrying flowers, picture frames, a new American flag. There was even an 80-year-old man with a trumpet who would play taps at the end. Within seconds, the coffin was moving, the family following behind, everyone on their way. "We got it from here," Flat Nose said to Zig, raising his hand like a crossing guard. For Zig, the job was done. Yet as he stared down at Flatnose's gleaming shoes, as he replayed the confusion on Tessa's face when she heard her husband worked at Dover, and especially as he noticed the way Flatnose was gripping Tessa's arm, practically yanking her away from the coffin. "Actually, I was thinking of attending the service," Zig said to Flatnose. "I told you. We got it from here," Flatnose insisted. "I'm sure you do," Zig said, flashing a grin. "But, you know, out of respect." Sidestepping around him, Zig stayed with the coffin and Mint's wife, who held tight to her daughter. "See you inside," Zig added, following right behind them.
"And now, please join me as we pray," the chaplain began. "Almighty God," the crowd began to read from their prayer cards, their voices echoing through the bleachers. Zig stood just inside the door of the gymnasium, never taking a seat,
so he'd have a better view of everyone inside. On the far side of the gym, past the bleachers, Flatnose stood inside the opposite door. When the service first started, the other funeral employees were handing out prayer cards and ushering people to open seats. But even now, Flatnose just stood there, scanning the crowd, like he was looking for something, or someone. Something clearly wasn't right. But what the hell's got you so jumpy? Zig wondered, following Flatnose's stare to the crowd. Even in the packed bleachers, the funeral looked like it always did. Family members in the front row, mourners in the other rows, and a few strangers in the back rows, stealing glances at their phones. There were local politicians in nice suits, local press in cheap suits, and photographers and cameramen in even cheaper suits, all packed in the corner, a tiny firing squad, just waiting for Mint's wife to give her eulogy so they could get footage of her sobbing as everyone muttered words like, "so young and so unfair." And, of course, there was a smattering of elderly vets, the veterans of foreign wars, decked out in their old military caps, waiting to do the 21-gun salute at the cemetery and then go to the local bar to tell war stories. Zig wondered if maybe today was the day he'd go with them. A voice rang out. 12-year-old Violet started to cry, and now her brother was shaking too, silently. Breathlessly, they tried to hold it together, Tessa clutching them both, one in each arm, as every person in the gym stared their way while trying not to look like they were. Zig caught himself doing the same, then looked away. It was the only reason he noticed the door as it opened on the opposite side of the gym. A shadow flickered. At first, Zig thought it was Flatnose, but it was someone new. A woman with caramel skin. Zig assumed it was another mourner, maybe a reporter, someone running late. The shadow moved again, and as the light revealed the woman, Zig's eyes went wide. Those pointy features, the silver, moon-colored hair with a black streak. "Nola?" Zig whispered, not even realizing he was saying the name. He'd known her since she was little. The woman who once saved his daughter's life. "What the hell are you doing here?"
4.
Nola. That was definitely Nola. At the sight of her, Zig's windpipe clenched. Earlier, he'd been thinking about her saving Maggie's life. But 2 years ago, on that case at Dover, she'd saved Zig's life, too. Swallowing hard, he could taste that bitter, coppery tang. Blood. He'd never forget the taste of his own blood. On that night, Zig was beaten with a metal crowbar. Broken ulna, 2 black eyes, a severe orbital rim fracture, and 14 stitches between his forehead and chin. It was this woman, Sergeant First Class Nola Brown, who saved him. They saved each other, actually, from Royal, Nola's foster dad, who had tracked her down, trying to murder her. It had been 2 years since Zig had last seen her. As she made her way toward the bleachers, she moved like she always did, slow, determined, with unmistakable presence and power for someone in her late 20s. Nola didn't walk. She lurked, like a hunter, her willful lips pursed, her chin tucked into her chest, like she was forever trying to avoid being seen. It wasn't working. Behind her, hidden by an honor guard holding an American flag and an army one, Flatnose glanced her way, then lifted his wrist to his mouth. Handheld mic, like the Secret Service. He was calling it in. This whole time, that's who he was waiting for. Nola.
"Amen," the crowd said at one of those prompts where everyone knows what to say. For a moment, Nola stood there, studying the mourners who packed the bleachers, scanning them, her eyes sliding left to right. She glanced back over her shoulder, turning toward the honor guard. Even from here, Zig could tell. Something was wrong. Her eyes narrowed. He'd seen that look before.
That uncomfortable mental tug when someone feels like they're being watched.
Flatnose looked away, shrinking back behind the flags. If Nola noticed, she wasn't reacting. She continued her search, eyeing the coffin, the chaplain, the flowers, then quickly turning her attention to Zig's side of the gym. Zig stepped backward, out of the doorway. Did Nola see him? Not a chance. He was too fast, and she was too far. But then Zig remembered. Nola saw everything. Peering back across the threshold, Zig spotted her leaving, rushing out. Yet as she reached the door, Nola glanced back over her shoulder, like she'd known he was there the entire time. Their eyes locked. Contact. Zig stood there frozen, and then, like a child, raised his hand and waved. Oh, God. Did I just wave at her? Nola's black eyes narrowed. Stay away, she warned with a dark glare. Then she ran, dashing out into the hallway, a few people turning, but most barely noticing. Before the door slammed, Flatnose was moving, weaving his way through the honor guard, whispering something into his handheld mic while striding after her. As Flatnose darted through the doorway, Zig noticed that the bulge in his jacket was gone. He'd pulled his gun. Nola! Zig wanted to call out. It wouldn't help. She was already out the door, with no idea what was coming. Don't jump to conclusions, Zig told himself. For all you know, Flatnose is one of the good guys and Nola did something wrong. But across the gym, as the door slammed shut, Zig was replaying that moment 2 years ago when the metal crowbar collided with his throat. A burst of blood had flooded forward. He couldn't breathe. He thought it had crushed his larynx. Nola's foster dad, Royal, wound up again. This was it. Curled on the ground, Zig closed his eyes and muttered a final prayer. Until Nola rushed in and fired 3 quick shots. She'd come back, putting her own life at risk to save Zig. How the hell can I leave her now? Zig started to move, then stopped himself. Walk away. Avoid her problems. But when it came to someone in trouble, and especially when it came to Nola, he could never just walk away. In a burst, Zig darted up the hallway on his side of the gym and reached for the knife in his pocket. Damn it, damn it, damn it, he thought, knowing full well that he'd regret this. 5. Running now, his knees already aching, Zig followed the hallway around to the right. He passed a janitor's closet, a half-empty trophy case, and even the driver of the hearse, a young private with a moon-shaped chin who was waiting in the hallway, ready to take the coffin to the cemetery. Mr. Zigarowski, is everything... You see anyone run this way? Zig yelled. Mr. Zigarowski, are you... Zig blew past him, picking up speed. Nola and Flatnose couldn't have gotten far. Turning the final corner, Zig was moving so fast he nearly stepped on a coat that was on the floor. He jumped, hurtling over it. But it wasn't a coat. It was a man. Flatnose, face down on the gray and white linoleum, his arms and legs splayed outward, his body motionless. Mother trucker! If she killed him... Zig slid on his knees, even dropped his knife as he felt for a pulse. Thank God. Still breathing. On Flatnose's forehead were 2 red welts, 1 on each temple. Zig had seen those before, from Nola's favorite weapon, a homemade insulated glove with metal pins, just 1 centimeter long at the thumb and pinky. When she pressed the pins into your temple, your body vibrated with more electricity than a military-grade stun gun. Whoever Flatnose was, he didn't have a chance. Okay, big man, don't vomit on me, Zig said, tugging Flatnose onto his side into the fetal position. He tilted the man's head just right to open his airway and make sure he wouldn't choke if he threw up. Nola, you still here? Zig called out, rummaging through Flatnose's jacket, searching for ID. Better to know who he was, or at least who he worked for. Nothing. The ID was gone. So were his wallet, gun, even his radio.
Nola had picked him clean. So what the hell does this have to do with Colonel Mint? Zig wondered, putting away his knife and remembering the Dover report. 2 nights ago, during what seemed like a home invasion, a robber had shot Archie Mint in the face and murdered a valet named Anthony Wojowicz. Did Nola come here for Mint? Or did she know the valet? Mint seemed more likely. He and Nola were both military. But as Zig rolled the facts through his brain, he couldn't shake the feeling that if the government was sending armed agents to a funeral and hiding Mint's real assignment from his own wife, this was about far more than a petty robbery. So what was Nola's stake? Zig took another look around. On this side of the gym, the long hallway was empty. Straight ahead was a doorway that led outside. On his left was a staircase that led upstairs. Wherever she went, Nola was gone. Of course she is, Zig thought, still reeling from the sheer coincidence of... Wait. Zig closed his eyes, replaying it again. God, how could he be so blind? For Nola to be here at the exact same time, in the exact same spot that Zig was. No way was this all a coincidence. Pulling out his phone and stepping over Flatnose to give himself some space, Zig clicked to recent calls. Dover Air Force Base. He gave it a tap. It rang twice. Mortuary Branch Chief, Will with 1L answered. How can I... You think I'm a damn moron? Ziggy, is that... I know you have caller ID, Will, and I also know you're full of manure, Zig said, still scouring the hallway and shoving open the door that led outside. There was a parking lot with scattered orange traffic cones, the practice area for driver's ed, fenced in. If Nola came this way, she'd have to go up and over the fence. Zig let the door shut and headed for the stairwell. This case, Will. No more lies. Why'd you put me on this case? I told you, please don't say it's because I'm the best sculptor. I swear on my mother's eyes, Zig, that's the truth. When the weather gets this hot, stiffs melt, and don't call them stiffs. They're our fallen. You know what I'm saying. There were armed agents here, Will. Quiet operators from the look of it, at a funeral. They were whispering in their sleeves like the president himself was coming. Ziggy, I have no idea what you're... That's strike two. Oh, and I spoke to Mint's wife. According to her... Her husband never spent a day working at Dover. Can you please listen? I saw her, Will. I saw Nola. There was a pause on the line. A long one. You were looking for her, weren't you? That's why your men were here. She's the one you were hunting, Zig challenged, shoving open the door to a pale yellow stairwell, realizing it was the same color yellow as the original morgue at Dover, to reduce stress and keep employees calm. It wasn't having its intended effect here. The stairwell was quiet, no sounds of anyone running. You knew she saved my life. That I knew her when she was little, Zig added. So you figured what? That bringing me in would somehow distract her and knock her off balance? Then you could send in the big guns and they'd... Ziggy, you have to understand. We had no... Who's we? Will paused again, then blurted a single name. Watley. Air Force Colonel O.J. Watley, Dover's new wing commander, in charge of the entire place. A year and a half ago, when Colonel Sue was promoted and Master Guns retired, O.J. took over the mortuary and its homicide investigation team. Why's the head of Dover looking at Nola? Zig asked, hearing a noise on his left. At the far end of the hall, a uniformed policeman was kneeling over the still unconscious Flatnose, checking his vitals. Zig's eyes narrowed. According to the funeral plans, security was being run by the Pennsylvania State Police, all of them in gray formal ceremonial dress uniforms and smoky bear hats. This officer was in a dark blue beat cop uniform, the only one in the whole gym dressed like that. Sir, can I help you? Zig called out. The cop stood up,
quickly walking away, leaving Flatnose behind. "Come to the office," Will said through the phone. "Colonel Whatley can explain." "How about you explain instead?" "Just come to the office." Zig hung up the phone. If he wanted answers, the beat cop was the far better bet. "Officer!" Zig called out. The cop didn't stop. Instead, he ducked into a nearby stairwell, the door swinging shut behind him. Picking up speed, Zig sprinted after him. At the stairwell, he shoved his hip into the door and...
"You had a question for me?" a flat voice asked.
Zig tried to hit the brakes, but instead slammed directly into the chest of the police officer, who barely moved at the impact. The cop was short, 5'8", but built solid, like concrete.
"Mr. Zigarowski, yes?"
the cop said, his voice deliberate and measured.
"You're looking for her, too."
It wasn't a question. "Excuse me?"
"I apologize for eavesdropping. I heard your conversation," the officer said. "Nola Brown. You know her."
"Who the hell are you?"
The officer smiled a broken smile that looked more like something he'd memorized than something he actually felt. "Roddy LaPointe." He smiled wider, working hard at it. "I'm Nola's brother."
6. Guidry, Texas. 21 years ago. This was Roddy when he was 7. He was a boy who was good at hiding things. This knife was a perfect example. He'd stolen the switchblade with the Packerwood handle from Gary Deburski's older brother. Holding it now in his open palm, Roddy liked the weight of the knife. It had heft, like it mattered, and though he couldn't verbalize it yet, he knew that not everything in life mattered. With his thumb, Roddy pressed the knife's silver button. The spear blade sprang out like a Nazi salute.
"Roddy, you dumb shit! We're not even looking for you anymore!" yelled 12-year-old Ellen P., the one girl on the block who everyone was afraid of. "No one cares!"
"I bet he's out of bounds," clucked Chad, a mouthy 10-year-old. Back before he and Nola got rescued from the group home in Arkansas, Roddy had learned the consequences of being out of bounds. Here, he wasn't out of bounds. He was 20 feet straight up, well hidden by the leaves of the crooked red maple tree that served as home base for their game, a hasty merger of freeze tag and hide and seek. Standing on a branch that curved like a hammock, he stared down at the tops of Chad's and Ellen's heads, watching them move around like ants. Roddy stretched his arm straight out, dangling the knife from his fingertips. A few weeks ago, someone had lit a fire in the newspaper vending machine outside of Margie's luncheonette. 2 weeks before that, one of the girls in Roddy's class had come home crying, saying her knapsack smelled like pee. And last week, a neighbor had accused Roddy of using a stick to poke out her cat's eye. Roddy swore on Jesus he didn't do any of it. In response, Roddy's new foster dad, Mr. LaPointe, told him, "There's both a good Roddy and a bad Roddy inside you, but you need to feed the good one. Do you understand?" Roddy shook his head. He didn't understand. "Try it like this," added Mr. LaPointe, a devoted churchgoer. "We each have a little monster inside us." "A real monster?" "Kinda real. Sorta real. Like the bad Roddy versus the good Roddy. You have to look inside and try it like this. In those moments where you want to figure out good from evil, well, you know that little whisper that you hear at the back of your head? That's your conscience. It'll always lead you right." It was wise advice. Lately, though, the whisper at the back of Roddy's head was starting to get louder. "I bet he quit," Ellen P. said, clearly annoyed as she took a seat at the base of the tree. Roddy wouldn't quit. Not when he was having fun like this, pinching the knife between his pointer finger and thumb, letting it dangle, the blade pointed straight at Ellen P.'s head. "Hey, Nola," Your brother run away. Ellen P. called out to the little girl with the black eyes who was standing there with the group, but somehow also standing there by herself. Who you think's weirder, him or you? Chad added. Nola stood there, eyeing a big rock on the ground, wondering what sound it would make hitting Chad in the teeth. Up in the tree, Roddy shifted his outstretched arm to the left, now dangling the knife over Chad's head. All he had to do was let go. He didn't even need to aim. Gravity would do the rest. A smile lit Roddy's eyes. An erection expanded in his pants. There was a deep thrill that came with thinking about the silver blade plummeting straight into Chad's skull. But there was also something else. Something Roddy didn't quite have a word for. You're definitely the weirder one, ain't you, Nola? Chad asked. Nola still didn't respond, didn't move, didn't do anything, still staring at the rock. Fight back, Roddy tried to tell his sister, his fingers moistening with sweat, the knife still dangling above Chad's head. She's definitely the weirder one, Ellen P. taunted, Roddy now moving the knife over Ellen, then back over Chad, and then, to his own surprise, in a perfect swirl of rage, embarrassment, and helplessness. Roddy shifted his arm so the knife was directly above his sister Nola. For the rest of his life, Roddy would think back to this moment. It was here, as the knife dangled from his plump fingertips, as he held it above his twin sister's head, that seven-year-old Roddy LaPointe finally understood the electric charge currently coursing through him. This switchblade knife with the pack-a-wood handle wasn't just a cheap thrill, or a childish impulse, or even a self-destructive whisper at the back of his head. It was power. That was the word for it. This knife. It gave Roddy power. And dear God, after all he'd been through in Arkansas, it felt good to have power. Roddy, where the hell are you? Ellen P. demanded. I'm right here, Roddy thought, staring down at Ellen's head, at all their heads, tiny targets that taught him what none of his future therapists or court-appointed counselors would ever take the time to explain, that the most potent power in the entire world came from having power over someone else. Naturally, at 7 years old, Roddy couldn't articulate any of that. He just knew he felt good, better than he'd ever felt in his life. He wanted that feeling back again, and soon he'd get it. In the distance, the jingle of an arriving ice cream truck sent the kids, including Nola, scattering up the block. Their hiding game was over. Roddy put the knife away, his adrenaline levels returning to normal. His foster dad was right, though. We all have a little monster inside us.